Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk with scholars, artists, and librarians about books, ideas, and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. Today we're speaking by telephone with Lisa Cabarica, who is in Florence. She is Director of Academic Affairs at the Medici Archive Project at the Archivio di Stato in Florence. And she also teaches Renaissance history for the University of California's Study Abroad program in Florence. Additionally, she's author of the book A Short History of Renaissance Italy, published by Prentice Hall in 2010. Hello, Lisa.
Hi, Thomas. Thanks for having me.
It's wonderful to be talking with you. First of all, can you tell us about the Medici Archive Project, just in general terms?
Sure. The Medici Archive Project was founded back in the early 1990s by an art historian. It was founded sort of as an alternative to a catalog system, which basically doesn't exist. The idea was to structure the database, which was a Microsoft Access database, around a series of material culture topics. It was meant to be a finding aid for this immense corpus. Because at the moment, and indeed to this day, there are only two sort of rudimentary inventories. One is the Archivio Medici del Principato Inventario Sommario, and the other one is a catalog of only the correspondence written to Cosimo I, which is the Carteggio Universale. Mm-hmm. So the original idea was to create sort of a finding aid so scholars could find their way through this immense collection.
Can you lay out the scope and size of the Grand Ducal Archive for us and tell us how it fits into all the other Italian historical archives and libraries that are the native feeding ground, so to speak, of Renaissance and early modern scholars? And maybe also say something just to remind our listeners of who the Medici were.
Sure, sure. The Medici, of course, the first family of Renaissance Florence, went through a period during the Quattrocento when they were essentially pulling all the strings behind the scenes while the structure of the Florentine Republic was still in place. However, starting in the 16th century in 1537, the Medici became dukes and then grand dukes, and the Grand Duchy of Tuscany lasted all the way through 1743.
So that's a period of what, 200 years?
100 years of being the actual dukes in Florence, you know, before unofficially the Medici during the time of Cosimo il Vecchio and Lorenzo the Magnificent were running the show but pulling the strings behind the scene. By 1537, they were sitting on thrones. So what we're dealing with here with the Medici Grand Ducal Archive, which is called the Medicio del Principato, it's interesting because partially it's a family archive, like many other Florentine family archives. For instance, there's the Archivio Niccolini, which has 1,100 volumes, register books and various parchments. There's the Archivio Naldini, which has about 1,000 pieces. However, that was damaged very badly in the 1966 flood. Many private families have archives also in Florence, the Pucci, the Capponi, and others. But there's a huge difference, both qualitative and quantitative, with the Medici family archive. Because, first of all, the Medici were very different than the other families. And being the first family of Florence, their materials were very, very carefully preserved. Indeed, the archive, as it presents itself to us today, is in the original order, in many cases in which the secretaries filed the materials way back through the 16th century. Of course, the biggest difference between the Medici family archive and that of other families is that in the case of the Medici, private was public. Because the Medici had a lot of informal personal correspondence, that wound up in their archive, but indeed all the material of state. And all this material was kept in the Uffizi, which originally built by Vasari for Cosimo I, was set as office buildings.
Yeah. And the Uffizi, of course, houses the great National Italian Museum of Art now.
Correct. And the Archivio di Stato, where we work, where the offices of the Medici Archive Project are today, was originally located until shortly after the Florence flood of 1966, was kept in the Uffizi building, the same building where the Art Museum is today. It has since moved to a big ultra-modern building near Piazza Beccaria in Florence, and it houses now what is one of the largest, most complete early modern archival collections in all of Europe. Mm-hmm. So it's mostly an epistolary archive. That is, it's mostly comprised of letters. The archive itself is composed of 6,429 volumes, that is in the Medicio del Principato collection. Mm-hmm. This collection, I always love this fact, takes up 1 mile of shelf space. I don't know if anyone has ever laid it out in an entire mile. It covers this chronological span of 200 years that I mentioned before, from 1537 to 1743. The collection is broken down as follows. We have letters that were sent by the Grand Dukes. That's about 320 volumes. Then there's letters sent to the Grand Dukes. That's roughly 550 volumes. Then we have letters sent by and to the Grand Ducal secretaries, which numbers 500. And this is a really fascinating part of the Medici archival collection. There's so much documentation of the bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. In this early modern court. Then we have a lot of letters that pertain to political negotiations during the many wars of Europe during this period. There's about 350 volumes just with letters of that kind. We also have letters from all the cities in Tuscany that were subject to Grand Ducal rule. There's about 650 volumes of those. Letters to the Grand Ducal ambassadors all over Europe, that's about 100 volumes. Letters from the Grand Ducal ambassadors, that's around 3,000 letters. Then we have letters to and from the Grand Duchesses, the Grand Ducal princes and princesses, there's about 1,000 volumes of those. And finally, then we have all this miscellaneous material, a lot of handwritten news reports that we call avvisi, a lot of travel accounts, treatises, printed sketches, pamphlets. There's wills, marriage contracts, all kinds of sketches and maps, various things. Probably the most extraordinary thing about this collection, I think, that now as I'm thinking about it, is that we have not only the correspondence and letters that were received by the Medici court, because, of course, when you receive letters, they usually stay with the recipient, right? Arrive at your house. But we also have, because the secretaries kept minutes of the letters that they wrote, we have a really good collection of correspondence, both received and sent. So we can reconstruct the dialogues, in most cases, quite thoroughly between these correspondents.
So this is a tremendous amount of historical information, then, isn't it? Which hasn't in the past been very accessible?
No, as I mentioned, I mean, there aren't really good finding aids. In fact, you know, we always say, you know, there's around 4 million letters that we are right now in the process of digitizing and contextualizing and describing. But I say around 4 million because no one has ever, till this point, been able to count the actual number of letters or folios within all these volumes. So it is an immense mass of material for these 200 years.
So if you can make this accessible, especially with full text searching, eventually it'll be a tremendous boon, I would think, to anyone working in early modern studies generally.
You can't imagine how many emails we're getting all the time these days asking when is the launch coming for the new BIA system, the digitized images.
Yeah, and when is that scheduled?
It's scheduled for the beginning of December. We're calling it now the soft launch because this is such an innovative project. We want to be sure to get it just exactly right, and there are a lot of factors and a lot of fine-tuning. So the beginning of December is when we're going to first release it in this soft launch form.
Is there a timeline for getting the whole archive into the system?
Yeah, you know, that's always been the point. You know, when people have asked me that, before BIA was on the scene and I was asked, you know, how long is it going to take to complete the entire Medici archive project, I would start talking about my grandchildren. And, you know, this is a project that in its scope, I always like to compare it to, you know, the building of the great pyramids in Egypt or perhaps, you know, a medieval cathedral, because it really is a multi-generational project in its scope. But finally, we can start talking about it because of this digitization project that we have going now. We can finally talk about it as something that will be completed within our lifetime. Currently, we have digitized 120 volumes of the Medicio del Principato. That's roughly 130,000 folios. Eventually, of course, we're intending to do a lot more when we complete what will probably be nearly 4 million letters.
And do you have a way of prioritizing, you know, so you're not just going volume by volume, or are you really just putting material in serially?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Originally, when we began working on this project back in the 1990s, there was a lot of coverage, for instance, of all the correspondence concerning Cosimo I, and a lot of work in the Cinquecento. And we had tried also, based on various fellows' areas of expertise, to let them also be led by their interests and which filze, that is the volumes, that they wanted to work on and to enter into the system. Now we're being a little more methodical. The Archivio di Stato has requested from us to begin at the beginning, as they say. So we have begun literally with, you know, number one of the filze of the Medicio del Principato, and we're working our way forward from there in terms of digitization. Because digitization is, of course, only one component of what we do.
Yes, you're adding metadata and then transcribing?
Yes, yes. Maybe I should go into a little bit the procedure that a researcher follows at the Medici Archive Project to enter material. Because part of what we're doing is quite different than what we have done in the past. However, we have maintained certain standards that have been ongoing since the beginning of the Medici Archive Project. Every researcher, the fellows, as they look at the documents, will scan the page and look for the various themes that enter into the topic categories. Originally, it was an art historian who began this project, so the concept was really to enter categories that reflected the material culture aspects in the corpus. However, we're not tying ourselves to that anymore the way that we used to do. Before, only those documents that contain those topics would be transcribed. Now we're going to be transcribing documents essentially in their entirety, and that will be in the original language as always, and then with a synopsis in English to the side. That is as it has been until now, and that is continuing. The aspect that's changing and really is going to make this possible to complete the project, as I mentioned, within our lifetimes, is that we're going to now be opening up this process of transcription and contextualization to the community at large throughout the world. So these many volumes, as they appear in digitized form, will be open for the community to pitch in and to add their transcriptions to.
So is this a species of crowdsourcing, and if so, how do you ensure quality?
I prefer the term community sourcing rather than crowdsourcing. I think of projects that are magnificent crowdsourcing projects, you know, like the Papers of the War Department project at the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University. You can transcribe it from the National Archives. These are all great projects that ask the general public to just, you know, pitch in and do the work. But our work is very, very specific, and it requires highly skilled abilities in paleography to actually read the documents, highly developed in sophisticated historical skills to be able to interpret, you know, who is writing to whom, what were the political circumstances at the time that a particular letter was being written, very, very advanced language skills. So there's going to be, you know, a certain amount of very rigorous gatekeeping involved in assigning particular documents and volumes to members of the community at large to work on. But I think that this is really the key to getting the project eventually completed. Right now, as I speak, the database has around 21,000 letters in it, and we need to step up the pace to hit our ultimate goal.
So is the project offering tools to help community members transcribe and do the work that needs to be done?
Absolutely. I mean, this is part of the really the new vision that we have for BIA. That's the name of our new digital online platform. The idea is really to train a community of users and to really bring the community closer to us in involvement. And we have already set up a number of courses that we offer that have been quite successful. And the way we envision it working now in expanding these courses is to start with that our users will be involved in our online paleography course that'll help them learn to read the documents. Then from that, they'll proceed to the archival studies course, which is an on-site course that we offer that really teaches people to understand the structure of archives, how to use them, and this helps them find documents. And so finally, once you've gone through those courses and done the training, you'll be able to work alongside the researchers here. And we're planning on having 2 to 3 graduate fellowships offered for people who are still working on their dissertation, for instance. Mm-hmm. And then they can take those skills back with them, back to their home campuses or back to their countries where they live. And because the images will be digitized online, they can continue their work and their research from different parts of the world.
Interesting. So people can, in a sense, blend their research with laboring in the vineyards of the project.
Right. I like the way you say that.
So, you know, apart from the 3 graduate fellowships, will people on the project have any reward except their altruistic contribution to something important?
Yeah, you know, this is a brave new world we're launching out on, Thomas. It's so new what we're doing. There are a number of other projects who have branched out and have done this. There's the Transcribe Bentham Project, for instance, out of University College London. Also, the University of Iowa has its Civil War Diaries and Letters Transcription Project. But, you know, really, there is not a lot of this out there yet, and it remains to be seen how it's going to devolve entirely. What I can tell you is that we're really growing and broadening in our aims and in our focus as a research institute. And I think we're going to be seeing a lot of new changes and a lot of evolution in the Medici Archive Project in the next few years. Already, we're talking about widening our mission in terms of more general advocacy for archival studies in a time when archival studies has been really threatened in terms of budget cuts. Mm-hmm. It's a very expensive type of research to do, especially for scholars who need to relocate and to do their work from a different country, in the case of, you know, American scholars, for instance, coming to Italy. So what we've been really trying to do is to offer a lot of alternatives for people. In terms of remuneration, we will be having a number of new fellowships coming through the pipeline that people should stay tuned on our website, www.medici.org, to see what we'll be offering. I can tell you, for instance, we have a number of sponsored special programs. We have the Jane Fortune Research Program on Women Artists in the Age of the Medici, which sponsors a lot of good work. And we are about also to announce a fellowship in the next few days for our Jewish Studies program. We'll be looking for a senior scholar in Mediterranean Jewish Studies. That'll be something that'll be sponsored by the Samuel Freeman Trust. We have a number of fellowships in the past that we've worked with the NEH, the Florence Gould Foundation, the Mellon Foundation, of course, CRESS, Delmas, any number of foundations that as we go along will be increasing also those fellowships and we'll be notifying the scholarly community at large about that.
It is a brave new world, and you hear the term in the humanities, digital humanities, over and over again, which seems to be, well, some people herald it as a coming revolution in humanities scholarship generally. And can you talk about how your project fits into this and this new way of conceiving research and teaching in the humanities?
Yeah, you know, it's true. Digital humanities does seem to be, you know, the flavor of the month and has a very sexy sound to it. But it also, realistically for us, is a lifesaver for the way that we can actually accomplish our research. I've had, you know, contact with scholars. In some cases, there's one scholar I know of in Australia, you know, who is constantly using our database. Many, many scholars who use our work. In some cases, it's very difficult to actually come to Florence, and this will revolutionize the way they can do their scholarship. In terms, though, of teaching as well, it stands to really create all kinds of opportunities. There are already a number of teachers, not just on the college level. Of course, there are a number of historiography courses that make use of the Medici Archive Project database and access our documents to teach historiographic approaches to the period. But there are also students, in some cases, high school programs, for instance, whose teachers have them come online and they use our system to get closer contact to the primary sources.
That's really marvelous. And the project functions really as a research institute, doesn't it? It seems to, I mean, if you're going to categorize it.
Yes, you know, and this is really the new vision that we have for the Medici Archive Project. You know, I've already touched on, you know, the teaching that we're involved with, the paleography classes and the archival studies. We've also begun a publication series that focuses on archival work. The first volume, The Medici and Their Archive, Power and Representation in Early Modern Tuscany, will be coming out soon with Viella Editrice, edited by Alessio Assonitis and Brian Sandberg. We also have a number of partnerships, most importantly with the Renaissance Society of America, also with the 16th Century Society. We've also been sponsoring a number of conferences of our own. There will be a conference coming up in June 7th. We've put out a call for papers on our website. We'll be dealing with the Medici and the Levant, and this will take place at the Archivio di Stato here in Florence. Last year, we had a conference at the Archivio di Stato on women artists of early modern Italy that was sponsored by the Jane Fortune Research Program on Women Artists in the Age of the Medici. So we've got a number of really new initiatives that go beyond the original mission of the project itself.
Something that strikes someone that hasn't worked a lot in Renaissance archives is the fact that so much material comes down to us in the form of the letter. And I wonder if you could talk about the importance of the letter as a documentary form for this period.
Yeah, the letter is really the quintessential form of communication in early modern archival material. The courts of Europe just were flooded with letters constantly of every kind. We get a lot of letters of recommendation, or what you might call letters of introduction. Someone's traveling and they need to be recognized, and who is this guy? You can't just Google the name of the person. Sort of credentials. We also get, coming through the courts, job-seeking letters. You know, these are all kinds of sort of requests for artistic patronage. They can be of a very high level. For instance, we have a lot of correspondence of that kind from Baccio Bandinelli. The kind of letter, if you know, that Leonardo da Vinci wrote to Duke Sforza in Milan. It's the kind of letter that touts the abilities of the artist or scientist or whatever who's looking for a job at court. But we have these also in terms of letters lower down on the social strata. Letters from cobblers, farmers, people looking for work, you know, sort of ingratiating themselves with the court. We also have a lot of letters of thanks, you know, letters of thanks for favors shown when the Medici have deigned to honor someone's request. We also have letters of receipt of presents. A lot of presents were sent back and forth. This is really a culture of gift giving. A lot of potlatch going on between the Medici court and their subjects. So you'll get gifts of, I remember one time looking in the wedding for Francesco I, the prior of Santa Maria Novella was sending some capers that he had grown. Doesn't seem like a fantastic gift to give to a Medici duke, but these are the kind of things that are constantly going back and forth. Baskets of fruit, you know, gifts of anchovies, all kinds of presents, which incidentally also give us lots of information about, you know, foods and flowers and all kinds of interesting material culture. We also have letters used as containers of news. A lot of news was transmitted through letters. This was a time when news was quite a commodity, and there were printed gazettes and newsletters that circulated during the early modern period, as early as the 15th century, but there's still a lot of handwritten news. And really, news then as now was valuable and could really be used as political capital. So it was also, in a way, a kind of a gift that people could share through correspondence. Letters, of course, were also vehicles of diplomacy. So we have, in addition to the letters of ambassadors, we also have a lot of sort of amateur diplomats sending their 2 cents to the Medici from all parts of Europe, because, of course, that is a good way to stay in touch and in contact with power. Then the vast majority of letters are, I guess I would call them almost office memos, this immense bureaucracy that left a huge paper trail. And you could really construct the decisions made at all levels of government through looking carefully at the letters received by and sent by the ducal secretaries.
You know, the question presents itself about what the motives were for the Medici to keep all these records so systematically. Were they thinking about an historical legacy, or did the archive have some practical value?
Well, you know, Florentine culture from very, very early on during the Republican period, really into the communal era, was always a very, very obsessively paper-oriented culture. You could not have had the Florentine Republic operating as it did, you know, from the 300 through the 400, if not for the obsessive effort of record-keeping of Florentines. Florence, from the earliest period of the Florentine Renaissance, had one of the highest literacy rates of all of Europe. It has been estimated that in 1427, when the great Florentine Catasto was launched, somewhere between 69% to 83% of the adult male population was literate. This really guaranteed that Florentines would keep records and be very, very meticulous throughout their history of keeping a paper trail. This began in the Republican period, but it continued through the Principate, through the Grand Ducal period. I think there was definitely an idea of posterity. There was definitely an idea of saving these things for history, and they were quite thorough in doing it. And we happen to also be very lucky that their thoroughness was followed through by good fortune that, you know, unlike other archives in Europe, the Florentine archive was not destroyed by fire or the many floods that have come through this city, that indeed this entire vast collection has come down to us intact.
They must have been preservation-minded in some respects, and I wonder, is that part of your mission in digitizing the collection?
Absolutely, preservation is part of it. I'm glad you asked that. You know, it's so crucial that documents like this remain. And one of the things that is constantly being discussed in this digital era is how to back up the most material in the most effective way. And I think that, you know, in the past, there have been a lot of microfilm that has been used to, you know, back up the material, both in, you know, in archives, but also in libraries like the Biblioteca Nazionale and the other, you know, repositories of valuable manuscripts, for instance, in Florence. But, you know, microfilm decays. Yeah. And a lot of the microfilm that was, you know, made in the 1950s and 60s is now falling apart and is barely usable. So the idea of backing up the paper documents on the most types of media possible is a way to ensure its preservation, and we're very, very proud to be part of that initiative.
You know, it's a kind of truism, or certainly something you hear from 19th century historiographers, that our entire idea of history was indelibly altered with the creation of the French National Archives in the Napoleonic period. And I wonder if you think unprecedented access to deep data-rich resources like the Medici Archive will have an influence on how we do history, or how the story of history is told? You know, what kinds of narratives will be generated?
Oh, I think it's absolutely going to revolutionize the way we do history, especially once the metadata will be available for everyone to look at. Because the information has been accessible only on site, only in this repository here in Florence, it's been very difficult for scholars outside to have access to it. But there are also preconceptions that people have about the material in the Medici del Principato collection, namely that it's only about the Medici family, or that it's only about the Italian Renaissance. It's only about art, which nothing could be further from the truth. Here in the Grand Ducal Archive collection, we have material about every topic you could imagine, and people will be fascinated when they see the variety of material that will be accessible to them. There's material about famines throughout Europe. There's material about epidemics and their spread. We have a vast amount of material that comes from the contact with foreign peoples in wars. It's fascinating. I was looking recently at news reports coming out of the area of the Empire, present-day Germany, during the various wars of the early modern period. And there was so much contact with the Turks, and there's so much information that people had on a very, very immediate basis with the enemy, that you get a lot of detail there. We get information about the communities of Jews migrating throughout Europe and their contacts with the Levant. There's an immense amount of information about natural occurrences, unusual events, you know, earthquakes and lightning and fires and all kinds of rich material on social life throughout the early modern period. We get to learn about the lives of the camp followers in these, you know, early modern wars involved more than just the armies that were battling. It was also the women often who brought their children and the people who were cooking and the prostitutes who were following the troops. So we get this rich detail about life in these army camps. In the courts, too, we have a lot of detail about intimate personal details about people's lives. I've read letters where Giovanna d'Austria, the Grand Duchess of Florence, complains that, you know, her breasts are so full of milk because she hasn't been breastfeeding her children, because, of course, children were put out to wet nurse at the time they were born. We get stories of, you know, really personal dramas that come through that give us a texture that's much, much deeper and richer than anything that you can get in secondary sources and non-archival sources. So I think it's going to be really an eye-opener for people all across various fields to see, for instance, how much material we have on the sciences. The Medici were great patrons of the sciences. As everyone knows, of course, in astronomy, Galileo is the most well-known, and of course, his student also, Evangelista Torricelli. But even beyond astronomy, the Medici were really fascinated with topics such as alchemy. Francesco I was an amateur alchemist. Medicine was something they were very interested in, as well as anatomy. And we have a lot of documents involving Vesalius, who lectured here at the University of Pisa. Also, botany is another topic that is covered a lot in the documents. Luca Ghini and Ulisse Aldovrandi figure a lot in the letters. There's documents involving all branches of the sciences as well. So I think we're looking at really not just more documents, but really a greater quality and texture of material to add to our knowledge of the early modern world.
So has working with the project caused you to think differently about your own scholarship?
Well, you know, it's funny. When I began in my graduate work, you know, my work is in something entirely different than the Grand Ducal period in Florence. I worked on Quattrocento Florence. I worked on 15th century manuscripts, which are known as Zibaldoni. And I looked at Zibaldoni. I read hundreds of them in the Biblioteca Nazionale here in Florence from the point of view of trying to understand people better. I wanted to get as close as I could to the people of 15th century Florence. When I'm talking to my students, I always tell them that for me, a really good image of a historian is the St. Thomas of Verrocchio. You know, you have that image of St. Thomas just plunging his fingers into the wound of Christ to verify, is this really true? Did this really happen? I think Thomas should be the patron saint of historians.
Not St. Jerome in his study, then.
No. I think that I'm a much more hands-on historian, and I like the fingers in the wound approach. So I feel like I already came to my studies from this point of view of trying to get as close as possible through documentary evidence, through the actual writings of human beings. But I've gone even more deeply into that conviction from working at the Medici Archive Project, because I've seen that history can be taught essentially from primary sources in many cases. the way that I have learned from the Medici Archive Project, beginning from my 3 years as a National Endowment for the Humanities Fellow, really was learning history from the ground up, reading what people had to say about the world around them, and afterwards enriching that with knowledge based on secondary sources. In fact, you know, putting the cart before the horse and really turned that, you know, around. But I see that as a model that can work more and more for people as they have access to this data. You know, language, of course, can be a barrier because, of course, you have to have excellent Italian skills to read these documents. Mm-hmm. However, aided with the English language synopses, and of course, once the documents are transcribed, so you don't have to deal with the paleographic elements, you know, there's going to be much, much broader access to this type of raw material of history, which I think can really create a revolution in the way we approach history of this period.
And one would hope that this kind of material will stimulate interest in people in learning other languages, especially as it becomes easier with online tools.
Well, I mean, we won't be able to do away with, nor do we want to do away with, the humanistic elements of what we do. The idea is not to eliminate good philological research, you know, good language study. It's not an idea of, you know, sending everyone to Google Translate and to, you know, we want to have the incredible scholarly rigor that we've always had, but it's about injecting new vigor into humanistic study and into archival study. Let's face it, you know, since the post-war years when we had such an influx of amazing historians, especially English language historians, into Florence, studying the Florentine Renaissance, we've had really a drop-off since that time as, you know, economic conditions in the United States are not what they once were. It's much, much harder to get long-term fellowships to come study abroad, and supporting oneself here is not easy in the economic condition also of Europe. So we're looking at, you know, a period where archival studies could either drop off quite precipitously if people cannot come here on site, but also stand now, given, you know, this possibility in digital humanities, to take off in an unprecedented fashion.
That's very, very interesting. Although, hopefully, there'll be some reason for scholars still to have to go to Florence.
Oh, absolutely.
Can you speculate a bit, perhaps, about what this kind of project and this kind of scholarship means for the Academy in general, might mean anyway, over the long term, in terms of peer review and in terms of the kinds of instruments and ways of doing things that scholars have that seem to be changing?
Yes, you know, I think there are some immense challenges that are offered here. And, you know, we have yet to see exactly how these will devolve. One of the issues is that it's going to call for a lot more openness that I can see among scholars. What do I mean by this? We are going to have on our BIA platform a scholarly annotation function, for instance, where scholars can comment on one another's transcriptions, can add all kinds of suggestions, corrections. And this is a marvelous tool. This will be fantastic to be able to share our work and to, you know, cooperate with one another. On the other hand, it can be a double-edged sword because, as we know, scholars can very jealously protect their own work. And until work is officially published, don't always want to be that open in terms of sharing. And so this is going to be a challenge that we're all going to have to confront together. And the jury's still out on how well that's going to work, frankly. We also have a number of forums that we're designing that are going to be on the BIA platform. And, you know, whereas the internet community in general is quite comfortable with using internet forums, I'm not sure that the scholarly community is quite accustomed to sharing the ideas in this way. And we've been dealing with a number of issues in designing the forum, for instance, about should there be anonymity on forums? Whereas most forums function in a way that, you know, whoever uses it, you know, has some kind of pseudonym, some kind of cute nickname, and expresses any idea possible, and often, you know, outrageous ideas or perhaps, you know, even insulting ideas, or any idea whatsoever. The internet is a place for free exchange, and that happens. Among scholars, we believe, and you know, we're still trying to fine-tune this, and our users will help lead us to make these decisions, you know, to really figure out what kind of presence do scholars want to have. And we believe that they'll probably want to have their identities known, because it is important who is making a comment, who is correcting you. We are interested in credentials and in the knowledge that is possessed by various individuals who are doing these things. But this is absolutely new ideas that we're coming across. And as we open up the BIA platform for the world at large, we're really fascinated to see what other kinds of challenges might present themselves.
Well, I want to thank you, Lisa, for joining us today on the Library Cafe to talk about the Medici Archive Project.
Thank you, Thomas. It was a pleasure.
It's been quite wonderful. We have been talking with Lisa Caborica, Director of Academic Affairs at the Medici Archive Project in Florence, Italy, who has been talking with us by telephone from Florence about the project and the unveiling of the archive in its online manifestation on the platform BIA, due to be made accessible in the next several weeks. You can access the platform and find information about the Medici Archive Project on their website at www.medici.org. You're listening to the Library Cafe on 91.3 FM, Poughkeepsie.